Welcome to Rants and Reason. I am Chuck.
I am Karen.
I used to be a Democrat.
And I used to be a Republican.
I am still a liberal.
And I'm still a conservative. But other than that, we're not really sure what we are. But we do know this, as Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we are not enemies. We are friends.
We are friends, Karen. And happy holidays to you.
Thank you. To you as well. Well, as we are nearing the Christmas season, there are two stories that always emerge as the mainstays of the season. And those are A Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life. But why? Why are those two stories always able to stand the test of time? What are the themes within these works that continue to grip the hearts of each new generation? Well, in A Christmas Carol, we find the themes of greed, isolation, blame, guilt, shame, compassion, and forgiveness, and the start of something more than that, reconciliation, and even atonement. In It's a Wonderful Life, the heart of humanity is explored, along with the questions that all of us grapple with daily, like what is true sacrifice? Is loyalty real if there's an expected return? Why do I feel so dissatisfied? This particular story leans heavily on the themes of perspective and of expectations, and ultimately of contentment.
Well, Karen, my particular favorite is A Christmas Carol, and I think that the George C. Scott version is the absolute best version of any of them. Now, I like the old one, but I think the George C. Scott version is far better.
It is good.
So anyway, both stories are redemption stories, stories that inspire us to be better people. Now, Christmas itself is considered by many to be a redemption story in that it celebrates the birth of a Redeemer, one whose sacrifice allows us to atone for our failings. The desire for redemption is what allows humanity to start over when it's destructive. It's what drives us towards progress. It is a soil that nurtures even the smallest seed of hope. That was good writing there, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, the questions posed and discussed in these really epic works, we see mirrored in our governments as well as our society. And none of us, even the wealthiest and the most powerful, are immune from the quiet moments of reflection when we have only ourselves and the choices that define our lives as our companions. Many times in those moments, especially the final ones, we find ourselves almost drowning in regret. Many a politician or anybody in power, whether seen as a hero or a villain, have reflected on those regrets.
One of the more famous ones is Lee Atwater. Now, he was a political strategist. He was a Republican strategist, and he was many different things to different people. He was described as brilliant, a dear friend, and also as sinister, racist, and cruel. He's the one that came up with the Willie Horton ads. Now, people are complicated, and it's likely a bit of everything would apply as it usually does. There's no doubt that Atwater was one of the great architects of some of the worst of the Republican Party.
For sure.
The Southern strategy that gave white supremacists a home within the GOP, and a delight of dirty politics that has shifted rhetoric ever since. Now, 39, Atwater was diagnosed with an incredibly aggressive brain tumor, and he died at 40. Before his death, he spoke out often about his political regrets. It was clear he was very proud of his success and who he helped get into office, but he was really ashamed of how he got him there. Nearing his death, these words reflected the shift in his heart and mind.
He said, "My illness helped me to see what was missing in society, and that was what was missing in me, a little heart, a lot of brotherhood. The 80s were about acquiring wealth, power, prestige. I know. I acquired more wealth, power, and prestige than most. But you can acquire all you want and still feel empty. What power wouldn't I trade for a little more time with my family? What price wouldn't I pay for an evening with friends? It took a deadly illness to put me eye to eye with that truth. But it is a truth that the country, caught up in its ruthless ambitions and moral decay, can learn on my dime. I don't know who will lead us through the 90s, but they must be made to speak to this spiritual vacuum at the heart of American society, this tumor of the soul. I was wrong to follow the mean parts of conservatism. I should have been trying to help people instead of taking advantage of them. I don't hate anyone anymore. For the first time in my life, I don't hate somebody. I have nothing but good feelings towards people.
Now, Malcolm X, he was a hero to many people, and to some, a provocateur who separated the races more than he united them. Now, he didn't know his days were about to be stolen from him at the time of his death. He was undergoing a major life transition. He had rejected the coarse version of black racial separatism that he'd previously embraced. He repudiated the concept that non-whites stood on a natural spiritual high ground. He also rejected such ideas as black Americans founding their own country within the confines of the American Northwest. At this point in his life, Malcolm expressed regrets of all kinds in a speech shortly before his death, said that Dr. King was right, and he attempted to unite with him in a show of brotherhood. That's not to say that Malcolm X did not maintain a fighting attitude toward injustice, but that he did express regret from some of the more militant positions he'd held and the divisions that they caused.
Recently, the death of Senator John McCain made headlines, and many speak of him as a hero, but some label him traitor and warmonger. Because he knew his time left on the earth was short, McCain made the most of his time by openly expressing his regrets and encouraging all of us to work towards better government. In his final book, McCain discussed his biggest political regrets. They were not speaking out against the Confederate flag flying over one of his speeches. I believe it was South Carolina, right?
Mm-hmm.
Involvement in the Keating Five scandal. Not picking Joe Lieberman as his running mate during the presidential bid, not speaking out more often and more clearly for pro-trade and pro-immigration stances, and for not speaking out more in support of the media. McCain even made another shocking admission in his memoir about the Iraq War. He wrote, "It can't be judged as anything other than a mistake, a very, very serious one, and I have to accept my share of the blame for it."
And someone else who was in the Senate with McCain, Ted Kennedy. Now, he's a champion for liberals and a very easy target for the ire of conservatives, who quickly brand him an alcoholic, a womanizer, and a murderer. Yet in his final memoir, the senator dedicated 5 pages to voicing his regret over the event that defined him to the right. Kennedy said his actions at Chappaquiddick on July 18th, 1969, were just inexcusable. He said he was afraid, made a terrible decision, and he had to live with the guilt for more than 4 decades. He did regret his excessive drinking, his bad behavior with women, and not being forthcoming on the infamous rape charges involving his nephew William Smith. He also purposely derailed Jimmy Carter's bid on universal health care, and he deeply regretted that.
Yes, and then we have Billy Graham. He reflected on his friendships with several of America's presidents, but he did acknowledge the nearly insatiable pull of partisan politics. Although he did not regret ministering to leaders of both political parties, he did express remorse for allowing himself to be drawn too close to President Nixon, who later was caught up in the Watergate scandal and resigned. Graham said, "Looking back, I know sometimes I crossed the line, and I wouldn't do that now." Although widely credited for his commitment to integrating the largely segregated Christian church in the South in the 1960s, Graham told the Associated Press that he regretted not participating in civil rights marches with Dr. Martin Luther King. I made a mistake when I didn't go to Selma, Graham said. I would have liked to have done more.
Another example comes from the Senate, and that's Robert Byrd. He was a member of the KKK. He voted against the Civil Rights Act. And as he grew older, he openly regretted these things. Now, he owned them and who he'd been, and he had changed. But this is how far he changed. This was a quote he had in World War II going into war. He said, "I shall never fight in the armed services with a Negro by my side. Rather, I should die 1,000 times and see Old Glory trampled in the dirt, never to rise again, than to see this beloved land of ours become degraded by race mongrels, a throwback to the blackest specimens from the wilds."
That's so hard just to listen to.
I think the mindset of someone saying that.
I can't even fathom it.
Right. So you think the guy's beyond redemption. Mm-hmm. That should define him for his whole life. And he changed. His views changed. And later in life, when he was discussing Dr. Martin Luther King, he said, "With the passage of time, we have come to learn that his dream was the American dream. And few ever expressed it more eloquently." And upon the news of Senator Byrd's death, the NAACP released a statement that praised Byrd, saying he had become a champion for civil rights and liberties and came to consistently support the NAACP's civil rights agenda. When asked about his time in the KKK, he said, "I know I was wrong. Intolerance had no place in America, and I've apologized 1,000 times, and I don't mind apologizing over and over again. I can't erase what happened. It has emerged throughout my life to haunt and embarrass me, and has taught me in a very graphic way what one major mistake can do to one's life, career, and reputation."
Authentic apologies can be healing, and science backs this up. But science also tells us that apologies can create even more angst in the one who was hurt and can inspire an even greater thirst for justice or revenge. Greater healing comes from apologies that are backed up with repentant behavior, a literal turning away from the wrongdoing towards active pursuit of the right thing. One example of someone who owned their behavior and turned from it was Britain's John Profumo, who by most accounts lived the rest of his life trying to make amends from an affair that he had with a spy. I believe he was 91 when he passed away. And from all reports, they said he just lived the last several decades of his life just performing very menial duties in charity work and really trying to make amends for all that he had done before.
Well, here's the thing. As we read these, it's very likely, depending on your perspective, that you believe these people just wanted to clear their conscience and found an apology to be the most expedient political course. It's possible that you're right, but you don't know for sure. And it's an important distinction. The fact that we often lack the ability to make that distinction is a symptom of a society getting so cynical it can't even appreciate the possibility or value of redemption. Now, it's easy for all of us to judge harshly and not give grace, but the thing about grace that makes it so unfathomable is that it's undeserved. There will be some people mentioned on this episode that you might decide are not worthy of it, and that's okay. We aren't asking you to. We are, however, asking you to consider the implications of a society that cannot give grace, that cannot forgive, that cannot believe in redemption. Are we so focused on shaming that we can't give that room for redemption?
One of the truly huge issues that drives American society today is that we're finding ourselves more and more shame-driven than guilt-driven. Guilt culture is built on knowing if you are good or bad by what your conscience feels, but shame culture defines your fitness by what your community says about you and whether that community honors or excludes you. Right now, social media is the largest source of community, and we're rapidly turning to shame as the biggest catalyst for change. Guilt in and of itself is not actually a bad thing. Research suggests that guilt is a more adaptive emotion than shame, and it can prompt a more positive, sustained response than shame. Shame and guilt lead to contrasting motivations and contrasting actions. Shame is typically associated with a desire to deny, hide, or escape. Guilt is typically associated with a desire to repair. In this way, guilt is likely to orient people in constructive, proactive, future-oriented directions, whereas shame is more likely to move people towards separation, distancing, and defense. Basically, guilt is more internal and shame is external. Guilt can become a powerful motivator when we see either the effects of our bad behavior, like in A Christmas Carol, or when other people's good behavior naturally exposes our own lack thereof. Shame also motivates behavior, but in a much more shallow way. Perhaps so many of the apologies that we hear from power players today don't ring true because we are increasingly turning into a shaming culture rather than a guilt-driven one. And they're just apologizing because that's what the community is telling them to do, and it's not actually something internally that they feel like they should change. Remember, it was a shaming culture that defined much of colonial America. And do we really want to go back to that same philosophy, just with different standards of what constitutes being shameful?
Well, as we become increasingly relative in terms of what's okay and what isn't, we really haven't freed ourselves of anything. We've just replaced it with new standards of measurements. Perhaps we should all focus on being the people that inspire those around us to change for the better. We can criticize a policy wholeheartedly without shaming a person.
Yes. Literature and entertainment prove that we all love a redemption story. Most of us, even in the smallest sense, desire to live one out. But the only way we can do that is to give one another a little bit of grace. We can accept an apology with a heavy dose of skepticism, but we can also allow for the tiniest possibility that they could be telling the truth. We can try a little harder to want that truth and to want goodness to win rather than to expect the worst and then delight in destruction. I mean, all you have to do is look at news story comments to see how people just delight in destruction instead of trying to hope for goodness.
You know, one of my favorite songs, Karen, one of my favorite lyrics is, you know, I love the Avett Brothers and they have a song, The Perfect
too.
Space. And there's a lyric in there. It says, I want to have friends that I can trust that love me for the man I become, not the man that I was. And history is filled with examples of men who were remembered for the men that they were, not the men they became. And I think the point of life is to leave a good legacy. Own when you're wrong, work harder to be the person that you can be. We recognize our own human frailties and imperfections and strive to be better. We're living in a culture where people want to define other people easily. We want right and wrong to be clear without nuance, without causing us to think. It's a weakness we're succumbing to, and hopefully we can stop. We've reached this point where apologies aren't good enough. You've heard me say this a million times, especially about the left, Karen. Apologies aren't good enough. They want your head on a silver platter.
Right, and that's very discouraging to you because you're on the left. I mean,
yes.
Kind of a clean your own house sort of thing. Well, it really bothers you.
We have some important questions, you know, important questions about women's rights, transgender rights, LGBT rights. And in those conversations, if you say the wrong thing, you can be buried. You can be branded as just a horrible person. When you enter into those conversations in good faith, where you want to hear what the other person has to say, where you want to learn, where you want to try to find, you know, some common ground. But if you say the wrong thing in those conversations, you can be buried, you can be shamed, you'll be branded forever. And no matter how much you apologize, it doesn't matter. And we teach our kids, what do we teach our kids all the time? If you do something wrong, learn from it, apologize, and move on.
Right. Be better.
Be better. But we don't accept that from other people anymore. It's not good enough.
And then the shaming creates kind of a passive aggressive thing where people aren't saying it, but they're still thinking it. So they're not getting educated. I noticed that with Megyn Kelly with the blackface comment over Halloween. And I kept thinking to myself, there's a whole generation of people that don't understand why that's wrong. They don't know the historical context of it. And I would love to see, instead of everybody making fun of people when they do the wrong thing, as offensive as it may be, I would love to see them educated. I would love to see people come out and say, okay, let me educate you on why that's not okay. This is the historical context, and this is why it's not all right, instead of immediately shaming people. In any situation, I'm just using that as one small example, but it's all over the place. I would like to see us educate one another, and then, you know, you don't have to stay and convince people, but just educate and walk away. You don't have to shame and get so angry.
Well, and I think if we look at the Megyn Kelly story, there's so many lessons to be learned from that. Mm-hmm. One, it was a really, really, really stupid thing to say.
Right.
And people say stupid things all the time. You hear me say stupid things all the time. And she could have said it was a stupid thing to say, and she didn't understand how bad it was. Okay, why did you not understand how bad it was? Maybe you don't have enough diversity of friends to understand. So now we're getting into another issue. Mm-hmm. But again, that does not make the person a horrible person.
Racist
or irredeemable. They made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And when you live your life in a microscope, and luckily I don't, or nobody would listen to me, nobody would talk to me, nobody would hang around with me. And that's
same
true.
Thing.
That's yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's really troubling that we don't allow for people to make mistakes anymore. I'm not a Megyn Kelly apologist. It was a stupid thing to say. And it was, you know, that's a complicated thing, because really they wanted to get rid of her. They were looking for a reason to get out from under that. But, you know, it was made out to be, and again, I'm not apologizing for it. It was stupid. There were a lot of lessons that could have been learned. But
just
once
grace.
You turn that anger on,
yeah.
You are not going to learn those lessons.
Right. Giving grace and saying that someone may not be a terrible person and trying to educate someone doesn't necessarily mean that they need to keep their jobs. I'm not saying, you know, consequences exist. You say something that is offending your audience and they don't accept your apology, they're not going to watch your show. There's ratings consequence to that. I'm not saying to ignore those types of things. I'm just saying that doesn't necessarily mean that someone should be shunned and shamed from that point forward. And we're just seeing more and more of that, of people being labeled by the one negative thing that they say rather than the many positive things they say.
Well, and I have three boys, and I like to think that as a liberal, you know, I'm open-minded, I'm taking the right positions, I have the right thoughts on issues, and I find out very often that some things, you know, from my boys, from talking to them, that some of the things I think are not fully thought out, and the consequences of them are not fully thought out. And they will have conversations with me, and they think I'm a horrible person, but not because of those things, just for other things, because I wouldn't
pretty
let her play.
Sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't let her play Xbox for 6 hours a day. But
I'm pretty sure they don't think that you're a horrible person.
But if you listen, you learn, and they don't just brand me as, you know, this old man who's irredeemable. They try to teach me when I'm wrong, and they listen to me. Mm-hmm. So that is the key. When people are talking to you in good faith, accept it as good faith.
Right. And realize that there are things that we can learn from one another, for sure. Part of A Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life is the process of taking stock of oneself. I know, for me, I'm the main thing that I'm taking stock of is the way that I judge. I'm going to try to judge less and remember that by the same measure that I judge others, I'm likely to be judged. And I know for one that I need a lot of grace. So I'm going to try to give it. Well, even to you, Chuck.
You do give a lot of grace, Karen. You give a lot of grace. And that I'm thankful for because I need it a lot of times. I know I test your patience.
No, so, well. I need it too. We all do. We all do.
Well, is this a season, it inspires many emotions, if we just said. A big part of that is inventory. We review what and who we have in our lives. We grieve what we've lost. We're quiet for a moment. We reflect on things bigger than ourselves, and often we find regret. Now, one of the strange habits I have, maybe it's strange, maybe it's not, I don't really have a big party or like to have big parties on New Year's Eve. I like to be up at midnight, you know, when the kids were little or whatever. But now that I'm older, after midnight, it's a very quiet night for me. And I like to write a lot of things, and I like to just write and reflect on the year. And you often do find regret. You find happiness. You grieve the losses that you have. But anyway, I'm getting derailed here. The Huffington Post ran an article a few years ago listing the top five regrets voiced by hospice patients. And this was the list. I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life others expected of me. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends and my family. I wish I had let myself be happier.
Wow. Well, if we are breathing, we have the chance to right the ship so that we won't find ourselves with a bunch of I wishes, but instead, I haves. I have had the courage to live a life true to myself. I have spent some time playing and not just working. I have had the courage to express my feelings. I have stayed in touch with my friends and family even when we disagreed. I have let myself be happy. So we'll leave you with this quote from It's a Wonderful Life. Now, we can get through this thing, all right. We've just got to stick together, though. We've got to have faith in each other.
And that is all we have to say about that.
Okay, not really. I just want to tell everybody, may your season be filled with peace, joy, love, and light. And I especially want you to know, if you have lost a family member or had a difficult time, if you're one of the people who had family members that were affected by the fires in California or any of the natural disasters this year, just any of the difficult things that happened this year, just if you lost someone that you love, my heart is with you. I know what a difficult and lonely time this is. And I'm thinking about you. And I pray and I hope that you will find peace and joy, just a deep, deep joy this season, no matter what your circumstance. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.